Hello and welcome to the PR Week, PR Week's regular weekly roundup of everything that matters in the worlds of PR and communications. My name's Steve Barrett. I'm the editorial director of PR Week, going to guide you gently through another show. We're through with the awards, the PR Week Awards, 25th anniversary. That was a great show last Friday morning. We were a little bit soft around the edges, weren't we, Frank Washington?
Some more than others.
But we got through it. Frank's our executive editor, my regular co-host. And I suppose we've got to admit that we are now into year 26.
We are.
We've made that 25th anniversary.
Stretched it for about
15 months, probably longer. Yeah. And it's year 26 is off and running. And who better to start that period off then, a great guest, Diana Littman, who's US CEO of MSL. Diana, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a thrill to be here and happy birthday.
Thank you. The longest birthday in history.
Absolutely.
And we will.
As you get older, you're supposed to make those birthdays a little shorter.
I know. And believe me, in my personal life, I do. But actually, you've kind of, your agency career kind of started around the same time, just a little bit before PR Week US, didn't it? So you've sort of been in the space about 26 years, started at Conan Wolfe, then went to Marina Maher, and then have been US CEO at MSL for the last 6 years. So looking forward to digging into some of that stuff. We'll do a PR Week Awards wash up. We'll talk about the PR Week Women of Distinction that was announced this week. Where's Kate Middleton? Frank Washcook will let you know and assess the Palace Communications response. What did you make of that Don Lemon Elon Musk interview? We'll dig into that. Olivia Rodrigo has pulled back on contraceptive giveaways at her concerts. We'll talk about that. And Unilever, it's spinning off its ice cream business, including Ben and Jerry's. What's behind that? And what's next for Corn Kid? The big question of the week. We interviewed Corn Kid, PR Week Diana Bradley, caught up with him and his mother, and we'll find out what's going on there. But let's start with you, Diana. Yeah, reflect on that sort of 25 years in the agency world and how it's changed. I mean, that was on our mind a lot at the awards and in the last year. I suppose some things have stayed the same and some skills have stayed the same, but if you look at it now compared to what it was back then, it's a different business. I think you were talking about cutting out, pasting and cutting out clips and all that fun stuff when you started off in the business.
Yeah, I don't know that was the fun stuff, but it was definitely the stuff of your daily life. I'm thrilled that is no longer part of our daily lives in this industry, because having your fingerprint stuck to a piece of tape based on a newspaper clip that you're clipping and then faxing to your clients, that there was a laborious piece to that. So
let the robots do
that. Exactly. We've graduated past that and maybe we'll graduate past it in other interesting ways. I hadn't even thought about the fact that my career is just a little bit older than PR Week. So that's interesting. Thank you for counting my years.
Those still youngsters.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for counting my years as well. I have loved watching the industry evolve and being part of it. I think that what attracted me to the industry in the first place, the storytelling aspect of it, the creativity, the strategy that goes behind every bit of client counsel that we give in terms of how you appear in the world and how you should show up in the world, not just in what you say, but how you behave, I think is so, still core to every single thing that we do. Our tools have changed dramatically. We always talk about shrinking newsrooms. The newsroom has expanded exponentially, and our ability to tell stories in different places, it's just gotten so much more interesting and so much more dynamic. And I think we're very lucky for it as an industry.
And I noticed you studied journalism at college.
I did.
Are you glad that you didn't go into that shrinking industry that myself and Frank are stuck in and went into PR? Because like you say, that's the destination now. I went to my alma mater in the UK a few weeks ago, and they have in the journalism department, they have a PR professor. That would never have happened back then.
Yeah. And maybe we're a little bit different in age because, sorry to report that. But when
I was a late convert, though, to be fair. I was already in my 30s when I went into the journalism department.
Yeah. there were, as part of my studies in journalism, mass communications and communications in general was part of that. So, you know, PR was a piece of it. And I actually was intentional about moving into the public relations field after university. What I liked about it, and both of my parents were teachers, and, you know, what I liked about it was I was learning a skill in terms of how to communicate, and I could kind of choose my own adventure in the area that I focused in. So I don't know that I ever had the intention of being a journalist. I'd trade seats with you any day because this is exciting. The work that you do is exciting, but I do, you know, I don't want to trade seats with anybody. I'm in a very privileged and lucky position.
You're doing pretty well.
Thank you.
We love what we do, and this is the fun part of what we do, but there's plenty of things that are part of the job that aren't so much fun. And bringing it up to date, you're CEO of US CEO of MSL, the Publicis PR arm. You've been there since 2018. Bit of a turnaround story in the last 3 years. Great growth. I was looking back at that. 9% up in 21, 11% up in 22, and even in 23, which was a tough year for most people, up 6%. That's pretty good. So what's the secret to your success, Diana, apart from excellence?
Well, we are a very ambitious team across the board. We have ambition for each other, for the work that we do, and for our clients. It's my leadership within the agency, but every single person at the agency, we very much consider a leader. And I think that shows, you know, through the work that we do. We've been very lucky with our growth, and, you know, that momentum is exciting, and it feeds more momentum across the board. I actually arrived at the very, very tail end of 2018. So I can tell how you all count your years. I've been there. I'm moving into my sixth year now. Mm-hmm. So I've completed 5 years at the agency. It's been a very complicated 5 years with everything that's happened in the world, both from a social perspective. Absolutely. And a health perspective. But, you know, at the agency, we've been very fortunate to, as I said, you know, that ambition plays a big role. But also, we are very singularly focused on building our clients' influence and making every client more influential in the worlds that they operate in, you know, but or the world at large. And I think that focus for us has benefited the way that we work with our clients and the kind of work that we can do and the growth that they have, which, of course, is completely related to the growth that we have.
Yeah. And if we look at talking about the PR Week Awards, you had an incredible night. You won one honor, but you also got 8 honorable mentions, which is as many as I can remember one agency getting. And whilst I guess you would have loved to have tipped a couple of those over the line into winners, it's still an incredible achievement. I'm just looking at some of the brands here: Jimmy John's, Swiffer, Campbell's, Crest, Oral-B, Dunkin', Always, US Soy. I mean, these are brands that people are using every day. And you tell me, you know, that they were thriving last year, presumably, and really contributed to your growth and doing some great work for them.
Absolutely. And we're very lucky at MSL. We have a roster of client partners that is beyond enviable across the board. And, you know, clients that want to push the envelope and really understand the power of communications and the power of what they do. So we did have a wonderful evening at the PR Week Awards. We had lots of celebration at our tables with our clients who were there in force with us, who, you know, felt so good about the results. Of course, you always want to win. And we were so proud of the work that we've done on behalf of P&G in the oral care space with Closing America's Smile Gap, which was a winner and was the honorable mention for best campaign of the year. But all those other honorable mentions mean the world to us. And as a judge of the PR Week Awards, both in the U.S. and globally, I know how competitive it is. So that felt good. That night was an incredible night. And it's just a testament to the work that our teams do every day in very, very deep partnership with a great group of clients.
Yeah. And whether you're doing work that is purpose driven or whether you're doing work that is just fun and selling more stuff, it's equally important and equally creative. And the Crestoral Bee, as you said, was a great piece of work that did have a purposeful
Absolutely.
Underpinning, didn't it? And how have you seen purpose evolve, if you like, given it's been under attack a little bit the last 18 months after being very much a la mode, shall we say, for 3 or 4 years? What are you seeing from your clients in the way they're approaching that? I think I saw Procter & Gamble, Mark Pritchard, you know, maybe 18 months ago, maybe step back a little bit from it. I don't know, but you tell me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't love this debate around whether purpose is entirely under attack, or valuable or worth our weight. You know, to me, I think that purpose work will always play a role in a brand, for a company, on behalf of a leader. And it always has in the work that we've done. I don't see us slowing down on doing, and especially, you know, as an agency that's focused on building our clients' influence, I don't know that I see us entirely slowing down on work that makes an impact on communities that our clients serve. You know, we do a lot of work, and I love the fact that you really recognize, you know, there's a lot of work that we do that's quote unquote sells stuff. And we have incredible results in work in that area. And we do really meaningful work for people in the world. Both are important. And I think both can kind of flow in and out of a brand's life cycle year over year.
Tell us a bit about the structure of MSL, because you're slightly different to some of the other holding company agencies in that it's one brand, PR brand around the world. It's part of Publicis. Publicis had a great year itself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know how much of that work is working alongside your creative and media brethren within the holding company, but talk to us about the structure. And also, you're the US CEO, but they don't seem to have a global CEO at MSL, which is kind of unusual as well for the global PR operation. So talk a bit about that structure and how it works.
Well, it works very well, as you can see, and as you've said, I mean, it shows up in our results, both as an agency. And you talked a little bit about that earlier, but it also shows up in the work that we do. And I don't think, you know, I don't think that that we would have such great results at the PR Week Awards, as an example, if our structure was not working well. So Publicis has a country model, and that's why there is no global CEO of MSL. But all of the global, you know, all of the CEOs, country by country, for MSL operate hand in glove with each other. We have a very close network, and we're very much client oriented. So we partner for our clients and on behalf of our clients across the world. For our global clients, and our network is just as strong as any network with a global CEO. So the country model works brilliantly. It allows us to build for expertise. And again, I think you see it in the results of the work, both at MSL, but Publicis at large.
So let's take one of the big pictures of last year, Walgreens Boots Alliance. Publicis came in and won that finally. Mm. It had a few goes at it against WPP. Mm. And but Weber came in and got the PR part of it. How does that, why didn't you get it? You know, presumably you would have loved to have been pitching for that, or were you conflicted out, or what went on with that particular one, just as an example?
You know, I can't comment on that very specifically. You know, there are decisions I think that clients make in terms of what they want to, just generally in terms of what they want to consolidate and bring together and what they won't. So, you know, those are all client decisions across the board. And so, you know, that's the most I can say on that, because I actually don't know the detail.
But speaking more generally, the big holding company pitch, is that becoming less frequent? Are clients looking at more sort of not project-based arrangements, but, you know, these massive Uber pitches? Are you seeing fewer of those, or does the PR element get brought into those, or is it mainly the media and the advertising part of it?
That's a great question. You know, we have a huge amount of client relationships that are completely linked within the Power of One model. which is the Publicis, you know, integrated model. And we do some of our strongest work within those, within that, you know, within that model overall. The, you know, and there's plenty of pitches and, you know, and opportunities that were networked within Publicis across the board. So I think that those pitches are still happening. You know, it's really client by client in terms of how, you know, and honestly, I mean, that's the honest truth. It's client by client in terms of how they want to build the PR aspect into, you know, the bigger picture. There are plenty of clients who are working in a app, you know, in an integrated model across their business. And I think for those clients, when we are truly integrated, it works brilliantly. We all lift each other up. And I think we get to do some of our best work. And as a PR discipline, we also have access to, you know, to data, to the media budgets in completely different ways. So it powers the work and it powers what we put in the market beautifully, I think. So our integrated partnerships with our clients are truly some of the most, you know, some of where we get to do some of the most breakthrough work.
Yeah. And building on that, it was quite funny in Cannes last year because Publicis was having a bit of fun with everyone else because Marcel was the original AI sort of initiative something like 7 years ago. And everyone was kind of laughing at Publicis saying, what is this they're doing here? And now, of course, everybody's doing AI and Marcel is kind of a teenager, you know. So, and then there was the $300 million extra investment. So talk us. We can't have a podcast without talking about AI. Tell us how that's feeding into the PR part of the business. And, you know, is it really making a difference now on client work or are you still experimenting? And how do you see that playing out as the year goes on?
I think we are very fortunate to be part of the Publicis network, because what Publicis invests in data and technology is beyond anything I've ever seen before. And of course, data and technology is moving faster than it ever has. So, you know, the past 5 years, even since I've been there, have been absolutely transformational in that space. I mean, we're very fortunate to have Sandbox GPT, where our people can experiment in a, you know, in a very safe place, experiment and create in a safe place that's not out in the open, in the open universe. So that's critical. And that's something that I didn't have to build myself. And that benefits me, that benefits our clients in huge ways. And the same with Core AI. So, you know, we flow in and out of reaping the benefits and also contributing to development within Publicis Group of tools that are going to really push our discipline forward.
Is there a piece of work, it could be yours, could be the group's, it could be someone else's, where you think, yeah, that's showing the potential of what AI can bring to this discipline and these professions?
Probably too many that I could name on the podcast right now. I think, you know, we're using AI creatively in very interesting ways. And you may have even seen the Publicis holiday card.
Yes. we always look forward to those, don't we, Frank?
We do, yes.
Yeah. We missed Maurice this year. Was he not? He wasn't in that one, was he? Or was he?
You know, he was in that one.
Okay.
Not in the individual cards, but he definitely was in that one, as always. But, you know, I think, listen, AI is part of the majority of our work in some way, shape, or form. And we're also kind of figuring out how we use AI ethically and very transparently in front of our clients. So I think this year you're going to see a lot of work from us that both uses AI, but also addresses the opportunity that we have as communicators from a brand influence perspective. Digital brand influence in an AI world is something that we're spending a lot of time thinking about, you know, through the mediation of AI and how brands need to show up.
Yeah.
And the how brand stories will be told through AI.
Yeah, but South by Southwest, every conversation eventually went around to AI, and I'm sure that'll be the same in Cannes as well. But great to hear the story of success, continued success, Diana. So thanks for talking us through that, and we'll get your input on some of these stories. We've talked about the awards, Frank, but anything, any final sort of reflections on the what was a great night. It really was.
Great to see the industry legends that were a special guest for the 25th edition of the awards in the U.S. Harris Diamond, of course, the former CEO of Weber Shandwick and McCann. After that, it started to give a speech. And I think for a few of us, we were wondering where it was going to go for a few seconds, but it ended up being very gracious in terms of
Matt Neal, because he hired him.
Story.
The agency
bringing him over from the UK. So that was terrific, and it was good to see a lot of people. It's great to see a lot of people you only see once a year.
You're not going to grab the mic off Harris, are you? Let's be honest. It's it's kind of difficult.
I wouldn't do that.
But no, he was great, and it's good to see Andy Polansky there as well. Jack Leslie.
Yes.
And Chris Komisarzewski from Burson Marsteller, great guy.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I also loved that aspect of the PR Week Awards. I thought it was fantastic. And I actually am chair of the PR Council this year. So for me to see so much, you know, agency representation and kind of looking at, you know, the agency world over time, I thought, you know, was just so special. Like it just felt like a starry night across the board.
Yeah, it's because they wouldn't normally come, would they? Because it's always the people who tend to be like on the work that's nominated. So we must try and find a way of keeping that going in future years and not just special anniversary years. But yeah, it was good fun. And the podcast was fun to do, and that's out if you haven't heard it yet. Another honorifics program that we launched this week, and Diana, you are a woman of distinction from the 2022 class, but the 2024 class was launched this week with our Women to Watch, Frank.
A lot of very impressive companies and representatives on the list this year, including Desha Barnett from UPS. We also have representatives from Disney. Kristen Campos from Mars Food and Nutrition North America is there, and she, of course, co-hosted the Purpose Awards in Chicago at PR Decoded last year, so it was good to see her recognized. And we have people from a range of agencies, from Weber Shandwick to Golin to Vested, and we even have some people from the government sector, Kimberly Hansen from the U.S. Army Material Command, and Liz Allen from the State Department. So really well-rounded list this year. And really great to see there's a few people on here who have already been promoted since the list was put together, or after the list was put together in secret, I should say. So great list as always, and supplemented by the Women to Watch list.
Did we help you get a pay rise, Diana, when we put you on the list?
Yeah, no. but I'm wondering, where's my promotion?
there's lots of honorific schemes and what have you, but what did that mean to you to be nominated and picked for, as a woman of distinction in an industry, you know, that is 70% women, but not necessarily at the top levels of the industry anymore?
Yeah. I now can kind of put away my 40 under 40.
Yeah,
I moved past that quite some time ago. Exactly. That was somewhere in the 2010s, I think.
Yeah, it was soon after I arrived here.
You know, I mean, I'm all about supporting other women and other women leaders. So, you know, that this honor for me was very important. The time that I get to spend with my fellow honorees, just in general, you know, there's a connection that you have with people who are previously on that list, you know, on that list now. You know, that it's a special group. And I, you know, for me, I very much appreciate your commitment to shining the spotlight on women who are doing extraordinary things in leadership positions. It is true. It is a field that has a lot of women in it, not necessarily a lot of women, you know, leading.
I was going to ask you about that, because if you think of the last few years, Anna Maria DeSalvo is, you know, no longer the CEO of the merged operation. Donna Imperato has left the industry for the time being. Barry Rafferty has left and then gone back to the client side. So there are fewer women in the top 20 agencies as CEOs. Is that a problem, or do you think we've got a lot deeper group of women in the most senior levels, even if not the top position?
Yeah, we certainly do have a very strong group of women in very senior positions. I'd like to see what happens in the next couple of years and how that changes. I love being a CEO. I love leading. I think I bring a special perspective to CEOing and an absolute love for the industry. So, you know, I'm curious how the industry will continue to evolve, and you know, the next generation of women will, I think, step up in very, very strong ways.
Yeah. Talking of senior women, this is a slightly different field, but Frank, where's Kate Middleton?
I feel like I should be asking you this question because you probably know a lot more about how the palace press operation.
Well, I keep saying to everyone in America seems far more interested in the British royal family than actually.
Well, I wish that wasn't true, but sadly it seems
maybe not your good self, Frank, but certainly enough members of our team and the wider Haymarket team.
It's a very curious case, isn't it? Yeah. And that they can't quite seem to come up with a coherent explanation of what's going on there. Right? It's that simple, isn't it? I mean, why can't they just explain what's going on?
Well, there was a picture this weekend, and now everything is a conspiracy. No. It was a body double. It was what, you know. I don't know.
Well, you also had this crazy thing in which there was this report out of Russia that the king had died, and then they had to put out a statement saying he was alive. And it's a wild thing right now.
Yeah. I mean, Diana, what did you think of it from a comms point of view? Because it doesn't feel like it's been handled particularly proactively. You know, one thing the queen was so good at was kind of keeping... Actually, she was a great communicator in the firm. They used to call them the firm. Mm. They were always on message, weren't they? And it was very clear where they were coming from. They were briefing behind the scenes. Do you think it's partly a function of the fact that the Queen was there for so long that the muscle memory is not there anymore, that they've got maybe different people in place and they're not quite as on the game as the communicators before?
Oh, how funny would it be for me to speculate about about the royal family's communications team? I think that there's a whole new generation, obviously, in charge there. The Queen was in power for so long. in her position for so long. And she also evolved.
Her
style and how she was communicating and what, I'm not spending a lot of time gossiping about it. I'm sort of watching curiously. I hope everything and everybody is okay. That's the main thing.
Do you, this is more of a question for Steve. Do you not think they have more of a responsibility to be upfront about what's going on? You know, and look, I understand that some of these things are health matters and they're private, but, you know, these are public officials whose lifestyles are largely fronted by tax money. I mean, you know, don't you think they have an obligation to say, here's the deal?
Well, it kind of came up when the Queen was dying. Was like there were all these rumors that she was dead already, right? And then people were saying, you've got to tell us, and et cetera, et cetera. I think it's a difficult balance to strike between personal privacy and having that unique position. We'll talk about that with the Elon Musk thing, you know, in terms of...
But I feel like they could give a little bit more.
Yeah.
And still maintain some level of privacy.
There is a certain arrogance in that cadre of people. I always, at this point, state that everyone should remember the Crown is a piece of fiction. It's not, it's based on real life, but it's not actually a documentary, right? There is creative license taken with that because everyone thinks that's like that everything is 100% true and factual there. But
this was not a documentary.
It was not. But it surprised me when the Queen died, the wall-to-wall coverage on US TV. Literally every channel was switched over to the whole for the funeral across the board. That did surprise me. I mean, the level of interest was incredible. So, and when you add social media into the mix, there are some interesting angles for us as communicators and creators, like how much can you Photoshop a picture? You know, as we never Photoshop pictures. I mean, come on, we've all maybe made a change to put pulled something out or whatever, or improved a picture. The front covers of magazines are
One thing that really interests me about this is there's sort of like, you tell me where I'm wrong here. There's sort of like a version of the White House press corps that covers the goings on of the palace, right? And it does seem to be unusually chummy in some ways, or at least some parts of it seem to be unusual.
Yeah, but back in the day when every paper or outlet had a royal correspondent, they would have personal relationships. I think things have changed in the media generally. That's, you know, everyone with a camera has got the coverage. And that was someone with a camera who took the picture this weekend, wasn't it? You know, on a phone, everyone's got the means of production these days. So it's an element of that. I'm English, but I'm not obsessed by the royal family. So it doesn't sort of, I was more interested in Manchester United beating Liverpool this weekend than what's happening with the royal family.
I was wondering how long it was going to. The timer says we're 30 minutes in, so you made it a half hour.
I did well, didn't I? Come on. But then moving to the next story, because it is similar. The Don Lemon interview with Elon Musk. Don Lemon was supposed to be doing a series on X, Elon's platform, and you know, they were best buddies for a while, and then now that the interviews happened, all of a sudden then it's certainly not best buddies, and Don's off the platform, isn't he? But he has an interview did go into the personal health details that some thought that whether you love or hate Elon, and he's certainly got plenty of faults, and his propensity for believing conspiracy theories and anti-Semitic tropes is particularly disgusting. But did Don Lemon go a bit too far in that?
I don't think either of them came out of it looking good. I thought it was just kind of a disaster, to be totally honest with you. I didn't think it was a great interview in terms of how he interviewed him. And I don't think Elon gave any answers that were particularly interesting. I mean, I thought the talking about the ketamine use was probably the headline of it. And how he has done that personally. I think when you get into, you know, him just kind of ranting and raving about immigration and, you know, standards for pilots that he claims is, you know, DEI initiatives are having an effect on. And the only evidence he can bring up is, well, there are these replies on X that say, you know, like it's just not particularly impressive.
Yeah, it wasn't the most nuanced interview, was it?
It also raises the question of how he got in this deal to employ, I guess, so to speak, Don Lemon without, I don't know, it just doesn't feel like there's a lot of due diligence there, does it? I don't know. There's a lot of wacky things going on X, obviously, and this is
and if you're talking about, I guess one of Don Lemon's sort of public interest defenses would be, well, look, this guy's involved in space exploration. He works with the government. He's funded by the government in a lot of ways. Do we want someone who takes ketamine or other drugs in such a lofty position or receiving monies? But then I sort of think back to Winston Churchill's, going back to the Crown, his daily diet was quite an interesting one, or even Queen Victoria. So, but anyway, as a pure piece of journalism or interview, Diana, what did you make of it? What did you think? Did anyone come out of it well?
How could I say yes to that? How could I say yes to that? Both. I mean, it's a,
Don Lemon clearly thought he came out of it okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's a,
not a man with a small ego.
Yeah. That was a complicated piece going in and going out, I think.
Yeah.
We all miss his New Year's Eve antics, right? I mean, it was entertaining as far as New Year's Eve stuff goes. Just saying. Don Lemon, not Elon.
Not Anderson Cooper.
No. Anyway.
All right. No one wants to talk about that, so we'll move on. Let's talk about pop stars giving away contraceptives. Olivia Rodrigo, what's the story there?
Yeah, she was
been in the news.
Right, as part of her latest tour. And, you know, this is happening in states like Missouri, where there are, you know, restrictive laws about women's health care. Her tour was giving away emergency contraceptives, condoms, things of that nature. And it was in booths hosted by organizations like Text Right by You and the Missouri Abortion Fund, and they're no longer doing that. And the reason, and this is according to Variety, it was that eventually the decision was made by the tour and the organizations involved that there were just basically too many kids going there, for they weren't ready for this. So ultimately they stopped doing it.
Now, was there any brand particularly involved in that, or was it just a sort of generic giving away contraceptives?
Yeah, I think the organization, well, I mean, she in and of herself is a brand, of course, but, you know, I think that the groups like Text Right by You, which is a youth focused hotline, that provides, reproductive healthcare resources, were involved in it, but, not necessarily any brands being really roped into it from what I can tell.
Dan, you work with a lot of consumer brands in that space with, Procter & Gamble and others. What does it really speak to how sensitive you've got to be when you're targeting young people with any sort of commercial messaging? And not that this was particularly commercial, but it's you've got a responsibility as a marketer and as a communicator.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of putting it. I think you do have a responsibility. I think that, you know, you also have a responsibility to the things that you believe in. Mm. And it seems that, you know, Olivia Rodrigo has a strong belief and, you know, and wants to support a cause that she cares deeply about. This is her decision of what, you know, the experience that she, her decision in, you know, whether it's happening or not in terms of the experience that she wants to provide her fans. I don't know, you know, and you just asked Frank about brands. I don't know if, you know, this was brand, like, corporately brand sponsored. It doesn't seem it from everything that I can see. So I don't know that this is a marketing, you know, a marketing situation from a corporate perspective. I think that this is a, you know, talk about, you know, kind of purpose and something that she believes in and wanting to use a space and a place that she has to, you know, support her community across the board. Mm-hmm. And now has made a decision in terms of, you know, in terms of what will happen and won't. And I respect her very much for that. And I respect, you know, we want to talk about being influential and being a positive force of influence across the board. I think that's good. Sometimes you do have to make decisions about who your audience is and where you're going to move.
I have a hard time believing people don't know what they're signing up for when they go to a concert.
I guess you've been to a concert before.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just don't. I don't think, like, you know, you go to a concert and you're like, shock, wow, this is the person's political views. Wow.
Yeah.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like, and certain bands, it's obvious, isn't it? Yeah. Certain bands I used to, as Diana pointed out, in my
youth,
which was a lot longer ago in the punk era and what have you, they were certainly making social statements. And that was one of the attractions. I think it's interesting to compare now maybe with Taylor Swift. She's clearly has to think really carefully about how she messages because she has such influence over young people. And I think she does a really good job of it, you know. And because we all see what can happen on social media. You can get eviscerated. You can just get into such a negative hellhole, basically, if you don't do it right. So it's not something to be taken lightly, but these are important discussions to be had as well. And these are important influences. And that's all part of the process of assessing influencer marketing and how you carry that out. So, and I guess the next story is kind of connected as well. Well, Unilever is potentially spinning off its ice cream business, which includes a bunch of different brands, but most notably Ben and Jerry's,
So this is largely being covered as like through the political lens and like the issues lens, and I think not quite enough through the, you know, just the pure business end of it. The Wall Street Journal described Unilever's ownership of Ben and Jerry's as, and this is their quote, one of the corporate world's most unusual and torturous partnerships. And the torturous seems a little heavy-handed to me, but this is not just like they're spinning off Ben and Jerry's. They're spinning off the entire ice cream business. And it looks like they are not exactly unhappy to be getting rid of 7,500 jobs in the process. And you know, look, their share price was up a lot on it when they announced this. So the market is liking what they're doing, but they're also getting rid of these brands like Magnum and Walls and these other ice cream brands. So it's not necessarily like one thing happened with the political differences, perhaps, between Unilever and Ben and Jerry's that was like a splitting point, you know.
Yeah, you make a good point there.
They're just spinning off their ice cream business to me more than, you know, I'm sure there are some headaches they're glad they don't have to deal with in Unilever's corporate.
And that is a challenging business at the moment, the ice cream business not growing. They had that Good Humor brand, which was the ice cream trucks and the music that was based on a racist trope. There was an award-winning PR campaign by Edelman, actually, to get that changed, you know, and that was a Unilever brand as well, doing that work.
So. Yeah, and good for them on that, because I don't think that was an educational aspect to that, too, because I don't think a lot of people knew the history of that song.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the ice cream group generates almost $9 billion in sales last year. So that's almost 13% of Unilever's total. So it's a significant deal. It's not like they're just getting rid of Ben and Jerry's. So.
Did you have any observations on that story?
It made me eat a pint of ice cream.
Now you come to mention it. Some stories do that.
Some stories do that, yeah.
But there, Ben & Jerry's is an example of a brand that has permission to do things that loads of other brands don't.
Yeah, right? They do. But, you know, Ben & Jerry's, I think, even rubs a lot of their own supporters the wrong way sometimes, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, their statements on Ukraine, for instance, I think a lot of people were like, all right, you know, didn't necessarily agree with.
Yeah. So, we'll see how that one plays out. And finally, what's next for Corn Kid?
That's the question.
The big question of the week.
Yeah, it's the question on everyone's mind. Corn Kid has had quite the wild ride over the past few years. He's 9. No, by the way, he's almost a corn teen, corn young man, whatever.
Corn teen.
Well, one thing I loved about this Q&A that our own Diana Bradley did with Corn Kid was it was not just with Corn Kid, whose real name is Tariq, but it was also with his mom, who describes herself as a mominger. She's part mom and part manager. And she is kind of winging it. She doesn't really have the... you know, a lot of managerial experience, and she's also just kind of they're going with it. So in terms of what's next for him, he wants to do a gaming channel. A lot of money in it nowadays. So, you know, we wish him luck. He has several social media accounts, one on TikTok, one on Instagram, and his older sister helps with the social channels, editing and posting. So all you need to know about Corn Kid, you can find it on.
Yeah, check out the article on the website. He wants to increase his reach beyond corn.
He still likes corn, though.
He still likes corn.
So if you thought maybe it was a phase, he's still with it.
Have you worked with any... brand mascots, ambassadors like this, Diana?
Any brand kids?
Brand kids, yeah.
I need to find the, you just mentioned earlier, you said United Soybean Board, so I need to find Soy Kid, I guess, right?
Yeah. Soy Kid, would be tremendous.
Yeah. Oh, good. I made Frank laugh. Yeah.
believe me, having worked with him for 13 years, that's quite
thinking of all the people being accused of being soy boys on the internet, so. There's endless possibilities.
We work with... you know, a lot of work that we do is really agile, real-time, creative out in the world. And, you know, and sometimes kids like this, you know, or you know, influencers like this pop up. And there's a really interesting kind of connection that you can make on behalf of a brand. You know, I thought that was a great piece by Diana, which is always a funny thing for me to say. It was a great piece by Diana. It's
whose
really...
pet hate, by the way, is being called Diane.
Oh, and it's probably I don't like yours that as either. Well.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I find that annoying too. The amount of times I have to say Diana, but that's okay. That's something we share in common. It's a complicated thing somehow. But you know, it'll be interesting to see how him and his family kind of grow up. You know, he has a following, he has a level of fame. What do you transfer that to, translate that to? I mean, he has a real name also. He's 9, which is what I was going to say, you know, younger than my child. Yeah. And, you know, and I think we've spent a lot of time talking, you know, over the years about the younger generation, and they all want to be influencers, and there's a lot of, staying power in that. And then there's also, you know, a lot of kind of transiency in it. So, you know, I'm curious to, I'm not surprised to hear a 9-year-old wants to, you know, graduate into being a gaming influencer. That makes a ton of sense. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of young kids that are going to be kind of interested in following his trajectory. So I am too, from that perspective.
We will keep following it.
Yeah, we'll keep following it and keep following him. And I think there's a fun aspect of that to, you know, the younger generation seeing what they do.
My favorite brand mascot was a British paint brand called Dulux. Mm. They had the Dulux dog. And I've never seen fans like it when the Dulux dog appeared. I went to this charity event at the Royal Albert Hall. The Dulux dog was there, and he was mobbed by far more people than any of the other stars there. Mr. Blobby was there, another one that probably didn't get across the Atlantic.
Frank and I have no idea what you're talking about.
This is a regular occurrence.
It was literally just a sheepdog. Like, yeah. Is this?
Yeah. Well, look, what's not to love?
That's it.
Yeah. It's the Dulux dog.
Wow.
And he'd carry a can of paint.
I was assuming it'd be something.
He'd carry
different.
A can of paint in his mouth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he's two colors, you know. So yeah.
Yeah.
There's Mr. Blobby. Slightly odd. Yeah.
He was not as popular.
Well, probably attracted a different crowd. Anyway, thank you, Diana. It's been fantastic having you on the show and chatting through all sorts of things. We've covered pretty much everything over the last...
What a note we've ended on.
Yeah, 45 minutes. So great to have you on the show and continued good fortune at MSL.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank. Don't forget our Crisis Comms conference in DC on the 18th of April. Really looking forward to that. That one's selling fast there. People can't get enough of that topic. Surprise, surprise. The Global Awards, they're in London on the 15th of May. Looking forward to that. The Healthcare Awards and Conference is in New York City on the 21st of May. And the aforementioned Women of Distinction Celebration, Gala Celebration, that'll be on the 31st of May, also in New York. If you haven't got your agency business report form in yet, you are running out of time. So please do if you haven't and you want to be on our agency rankings. But apart from that, that's all we've got time for. We'll see you next time on the PR Week.